up in the House Community, or House Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is the 8th of February, and going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4018 and ask our colleague, Representative Escobar, to join us at the dais and tell us what you got.
I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure. For the record, Sal Escobar, Representative District 6. We have House Bill 4018. 4018 is a carve-out and a anti-annexation for the industrial park in White City. There is a city there that we call White City, but it's unincorporated. It has taken, sometimes they're talking about incorporating it, and other times they don't. It hasn't had much emphasis in the last 5 years. And this particular bill has been in place for about 10 years and due to expire in June of this year. So therefore, we want to put another 10 years on it to make sure that we protect those industrial lands that we have and keep White City, if they do incorporate, from encompassing an area that's not really part of their city, if they do incorporate. So we have carved out the city of Medford, three entities there. It was Bear Creek, I believe, Timber Products, and Boise Cascade. We carved that out because Medford and those three entities have an agreement. So that's what it's about. It's not much to it. I'm here for questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gondry.
I'd like to yield my question to Representative Post.
Yeah.
Representative Esquivel. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gomberg. Representative Esquivel, we are becoming fairly well known in this particular committee. We'd like to know what's the emergency.
You have to talk to the attorneys. Actually, there is an emergency because this thing expires in June.
Okay. So that's, again, our urge that whether we have to, I hate changing the Constitution, but we need to do something. This would be an urgent situation. I'm not chewing you out. Urgency seems to be the word we're hearing a lot. There's an urgent situation. There's not an emergency situation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, since I've been in this building, this has progressed more and more and more and more and more. I would like to see this body put a bill through that required a two-thirds majority in order to have an emergency clause in a bill.
Okay. I have a second question.
Representative Post. Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This one's more more serious. The Dash 1 amendment, so we went from, gosh, a quarter of a page to six pages. Can you kind of summarize what it's all about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Post, the Dash 1 amendment is by Ralph Saperstein and Boise Cascade, and that's the carve-out of the Medford properties is what that's okay. All about.
Thank you.
In fact, Ralph Saperstein would like to present that Dash 1 if you'd like to set him up, Mr. Chair.
He's up next. Yeah, if you want to join you can get come up here now, Ralph.
Brian.
Yeah, Representative McClain.
Representing the areas at question, White City and around, the urgency may be an emergency because there is certainly the need to make sure and assure the mills that are and the industrial sites that are being protected from annexation here is imperative. We don't want a gap, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, Representative Escobar?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative McClain, we have the Boise LVL plant. We have a glue manufacturer there. I think Georgia Pacific has something there. We have Cascade Wood Products. We have substantial number of high industrial area in the area that's good family wage jobs that are very imperative to our economy, what's left of it in Southern Oregon.
Good morning.
Anything else? Well, let's, if you can stay, you're welcome to, Representative, but if not, we understand. Ralph, do you want to tell us what you know?
Sure. My name is Ralph Saperstein. I represent Boise Cascade. Boise Cascade is a forest products manufacturing and distribution firm with just under 2,000 employees in Oregon. Our plants are located in Western Oregon and Northeast Oregon. We have a state-of-the-art manufacturing plant outside White City that makes laminated veneer lumber. In addition to Boise Cascade, Representative Escobar mentioned some other companies. There's Timber Products makes hardwood, plywood, and cabinet products that are used throughout the world. Murphy Plywood makes all kinds of different types of plywood, including hardwood plywood. Though Timber Products and Murphy Plywood are supportive of this amendment, and the amendment is a gut stuff. The original bill extended the annexation ban for another 10 years to Medford and White City. The Dash 1 amendments eliminate Medford. It's just an extension of the ban for White City. But these companies, with the housing market slowly getting better, they want to expand and they want to add more employees, and this bill will give them the certainty of what their property taxes will be and the services that are there. And these heavy industries require transportation and all kinds of utilities that right now are being provided. And we think that it's worked out very well. They've been in the area for decades, and they'd like the certainty that they can remain there and continue to employ hundreds of employees in state-of-the-art facilities. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
So just to make sure I understand this, there's currently in statute, though expiring in June, a prohibition on Medford and White City, even though White City's not a city.
Exactly. White City is unincorporated.
From annexing this particular area. Well, not just annexing, period, but this particular
annexing industrial lands outside of Medford and White City. The amendment carves out Medford.
Meaning Medford can resume annexing industrial lands.
On July 1st. And Boise Cascade has worked with the city. Other Representative Esquivel mentioned Harry and David, and other companies like Timber Products have been discussing this with the city of Medford, and we have reached a resolution, and so that's not a concern.
Okay, so is the, I just don't know the geography, for this particular area, is it White's? So what are we worried about? Are we worried that White City first incorporates and then annexes in that same
deal? Right, because we're a cash cow. I mean, sure. We are very valuable plants. These facilities are state-of-the-art, and we continually improve them. And if they incorporated, they could see us as a way to increase their property tax base.
Well, I just looked at the relating clause. I wish it was a little wider because, as Aaron knows, I would try and include all of East Salem for being protected from the city of Salem.
You need to take that up with Representative Esquivel. I had nothing to
do. Wrong relating clause. It's not industrial land. It's residential lands. Representative McClain.
Mr. Chair, and I think Representative Esquivel will confirm this, there is regularly, I don't want to say every 2 years, but a movement to incorporate White City. And one of the arguments of doing this is we can alleviate additional tax burdens by annexing these areas. And so to what Representative Esquivel and Bates and Senator Bates did years ago was to just say, hey, you got to leave them alone. Mm-hmm. In response to that, the expansion has, you know, occurred, and these are very important zones of employment in Jackson County. So while it may seem to those unfamiliar a bit unusual to ban annexation from a city that hasn't incorporated or an area that hasn't incorporated into a city yet, it's more of a local flavor that I think if you are there, you get it.
Well, and it would be difficult, given the speed at which some annexations can move, it would be difficult to react if you waited for incorporation, because I've seen annexations move in within 90 days before here, where property gets proposed, and here we have to vote on them as well. So the only reason they might go a little longer is waiting for whenever the next ballot is, and say September. We vote on a lot of annexations in September's here, but you'll see them in like April, get on the council agenda for the first time, and then by September the people are being voted on by the public. So the council's already done it, then the public votes, and then by November they're 38% increase in property taxes, no new sidewalks, no new streetlights, still on a septic tank. Now it's just this local cop comes instead of the sheriff, and they pay 38% more. And usually they're not feeling they get the value without some plan to give them some of the services, at least, that you would theoretically think annexation would bring. And I assume in your case, these folks have already built all their own infrastructure for their companies to operate with all their own water, all their own working out fire protection agreements. So they don't think they would get anything except higher
absolutely.
Taxes.
And on those annexation votes, the company gets one vote.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's the thing that, you know, I'm fairly, I think, well-known among the land use crowd for, in their minds, potentially being inconsistent on annexation. The annexation is a part of land use planning, and it should, you know, it should always be available as a tool. But when something is already built, already urbanized, essentially, and now it's just a question of what the tax rate's going to be and what they're going to get for it, I tend to defer to the property owner. If the property owner says, I want to be annexed, that's a different equation. But when they don't want to be annexed because they don't think they're going to get value, then I tend to side with at least, I think in most of my bills, at least they should get to vote in the election, and preferably they would get veto authority in the election while everybody else is voting on what they do with their own property. So this matches my philosophy. Representative Holvey will not be probably voting for this. But other than that, I don't know who else may have a huge problem with
Mr. What you Chair, want to the city of Medford, you've never heard much about the city of Medford's annexation having problems. And the reason being is we go out and we'll do the urban growth boundary. And then the individuals that want to come into the city apply and ask to come into the city. So therefore, the only time we ever have a forced annexation is when we end up with an island. And we'll do an island annexation, and that's usually once every 10 years, where we'll have a little spot, maybe a lot in the city of Medford, surrounded substantially by the city, and then we'll go ahead in one swoop, do all of those that are around, surrounded by the city and city services as well.
And I think generally that makes sense if the islands are truly islands, and you know now the sheriff has to drive through a whole city to get to this one little house. That to me, I understand. What I've had trouble with up here is when islands are, say, 500 acres, they weren't naturally occurring, so streets were annexed to make an island. It's an island.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's like going to be 3,000 new bodies and 400 homes, and the neighbors are worried, are we going to get all the sidewalks? Are we going to get all those things? But it's done under the island statute. So I've had a bill several times to limit the size of islands to, say, 100 acres or 50 acres or something, so you don't use the island statute when it's not really truly an island. It's a one that naturally occurred with a couple houses that are making it awkward for service providers.
Talking about a cherry stem.
Yeah, it's just a situation where for my city, the mayor at one time came into this building and said, look, it's the only way we can figure out how to annex people, so that's what we're using. And that's not what the law was meant for, but I understand her point of view, which was in that scenario, the people can't vote. Well, if the people can't vote, you can probably do it to them. So therefore, let's use that method. And our council's backed away from doing that in the last many years, actually. This was back in...
Well, actually, this is a very unique piece of property because White City, the residential's in Representative McLean's district, and the industrial park's in Representative Stark's district. So.
Okay, further questions? Okay, I think I got a handle on it.
Thank you.
Anybody else here on this? I've just got these two gentlemen. Oh, not yet. We don't have paperwork yet. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4018 and open one public hearing on House Bill 4079. And where's Representative Stark? There he is. Please come up, and if you got someone you need to bring with you, great. Otherwise, tell us what you got.
Well, there are lots of someones here that will speak much more intelligently on this matter than I will. For the record, my name is Dwayne Stark, State Representative, House District 4 in Southern Oregon, including Josephine and Jackson County. I'll be the first to tell you guys that when it comes to housing and land use, that I am a novice in this conversation. And so I am not here proposing any sort of miraculous fix to Oregon's housing problems. or Oregon's land use challenges. I'm here basically with a modest proposal that demonstrates to you guys that I listen. And what I've been listening to over the last several months, and really over the last years, I've gone on different housing tours, is that we are in a housing crisis right now. We are being told that time and time again. In my neck of the woods, dependent on who you talk to, they will tell you that we're anywhere between 3 and 1% vacancy rates, which brings up a lot of issues on how can we resolve this. As I listen to testimonies, I've listened to individuals dispute how we got here over the last 40 years. I've listened to some people say that we got here because they don't like state land planning. I've heard some people say that we got here because builders aren't wise. I've heard some people say we got here because people don't follow the process. But regardless of how we got here, we do have a problem right now. And we have a whole variety of people offering a variety of solutions. Some immediate solutions, some are distant solutions. But whatever we do, we need to start making sure we're making progress, both now and future planning when it comes to land use and housing. Some of the things I've heard in regard to this proposal, and I'll get into the proposal in just a moment. I've heard, why would you consider expanding the urban growth boundary for housing? If you remember our land use planning, it's very important that we have an appropriate balance in taking care of our land, especially our farm and forest lands, and also taking care of people. And when we see people sleeping under bridges, when we see people of low and middle and even high income who can't get a house, we have to question, is the current process working? It seems like it's not. The origins, I don't pretend, again, to be an expert on. So I've had some groups come and say, look, some counties have a lot of buildable land inside their urban growth boundary. And I've reached out to some of those counties, and some of them have said, look, we do have buildable land, but the cost of that buildable land is so high right now that we can't build anything affordable for middle or low income. That's a problem. I've had other counties and communities come to me and say, we do not have any buildable land left in our urban growth boundary. Now, some could cite them for whether or not they planned well or went through the process well, but either way, they're at an issue right now. So what does this proposal do? It's very modest, because like I said, I'm not trying to solve all the world's planning right now, but rather just deal with a small portion and give people an opportunity to try something new. This proposal proposes two pilot programs, one for a community under 30,000, one for a community over 30,000, and it excludes Metro. Now, I excluded Metro primarily because it took all but 50 seconds or so of talking to people about the UGB issues related to Metro for me to realize I wanted nothing to do with that hornet's nest at this point in my career. So maybe another day in the future we can talk more about that. So what it proposes, though, is that these two pilot projects, that communities would have the opportunity to do an affordable housing, mixed housing development on the edge of the UGB, but an emergency expansion into the UGB for affordable housing. Now, I realize that this doesn't provide housing immediately, but what it does do is it provides an opportunity looking forward for future planning and encourages people to be creative looking ahead. The idea is that it is mixed housing. The bill itself, by the way, and I'm going to be talking about the dash threes in just a moment, the bill itself is intentionally written broad. And the reason is because I don't pretend to think that in every location that the housing problems and solutions are the same. What Portland is going through is different than what Bend is going through. And what Bend is going through is different than what Grants Pass and Central Point are going through. And so it's written in a way where LCDC can actually design some rules around this that are broad enough to make sure that if Bend comes with a solution about how to put some affordable housing in the way of apartments, that would still fit into the mold, where Central Point or another community like that might come forward with a mixed family, single home, single family development that would make sense for them. So I don't want to sit here and draft a bill that says it has to be exactly this type of housing, because I want communities to get together, to put their minds together, work together, and come here with some solutions to LCDC. So as I put this forward, obviously, as you'll see in the online testimony and the number of people who will speak here today, a lot of people had concerns. I've listened to those concerns as well and try to draft some specific solutions to those concerns. When I met with 1,000 friends, representatives with them, they had a couple concerns about, well, how do we know that people have actually made affordable housing efforts within their UGB? That's a great point. So the Dash 3s address that. That LCDC, when considering these proposals, will take a look and say, are they making reasonable attempts within their UGB? That's a great idea, of course. I had some people talk about, well, some communities that this is just going to be a land grab and they're going to chew up farmland. Well, first of all, I've never seen LCDC allow a community to just do a land grab. And remember, they have the rulemaking authority here and they have the final stamp. So it's strong guardrails there. But just to be sure, we made sure we built into the bill that high-value farmland would not be an option for this, because that's not what we're going for. Other concerns that people had, again, is the city following the process? And I've had some cities come and tell me, hey, we followed the process and it didn't work. And that's why I want them to get back together with LCDC and propose some ideas and some solutions. So when you're looking at this, and as you hear all of the testimony today, if you take the time to read the testimony that is online, I want you to think about a couple specific things and how modest this proposal actually is. When I hear time and time again people talk about needing to do something about affordable housing in relation to the urban growth boundary, you hear that year after year. Most of you have been here, all of you, as I look at you, well, except for Post, have been here a lot longer than me. Oh, Representative Helm, same time? Well, welcome, co-freshman. So my point is that if you've been listening to this debate over the years, for years now, people have been arguing and having this fight. And I think we've come to a point where we can say to those who claim that the UGB is the challenge or one of the contributing factors, that we can say to them, prove it. You say that you need to be able to expand to do affordable housing, prove it. And let's watch and see if it works. So is the risk of that worth the reward of it? I think it is. The risk of this, I mean, think about this. Oregon has approximately 62 million acres in it. That's a lot of land. And in 2014, over 500,000 acres went up in flames through wildfires. We're asking that you take a risk on a mere 100 acres. And that risk, hopefully, will lead to communities coming together with innovative ideas of how they can begin meeting the affordable housing issue in their community in a creative way that we can all look at and consider going into the future. At this point, I will take questions. By the way, like I said, I am not the expert. There are many experts who are here. I appreciate Lincoln County Commissioner Bill Hall, who came over. He testified last month in one of my hearings, so he came to share again today. And John Van Landingham, who has worked tremendously on this and has been instrumental in the drafting of this, is here to answer some of the expert type questions.
Any questions for our colleague at this point? Representative McLean.
Thank you. I just, Representative Stark, want to commend you in your first short session of your first term to take on land use. In my first term, first session, I took on water, and while it wasn't fun, I learned a lot, and it actually helped at least facilitate in part some solutions, and I think yours will too. So I know this is Oregon's sacred cow, but I suppose we have to decide which is more valuable, sacred cows or seeing homeless people sleep indoors.
Thank you, Representative McLean and Chair Klim, in commenting on that. One of the reasons I felt like it was really important that we deal with this in such a modest way in this session is because we're taking on the affordable housing crisis in other committees in a very grand way and looking for immediate solutions. We'll be having a hearing later today, or work session later today, on this very topic, on things that we can do for tenants. And I want to make sure that while we focus on the immediate, that we're also looking for the future and how we can make sure that we're planning the best we can so we don't end up in this crisis again.
Anything else for Representative Stark at the moment? He's in Ways and Means, I think, right now, supposed to be, so we'll let him get back to it. Great, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, why don't I finish out the four panel with Bill Hall and John Van Landingham. And what, Bill, this person who was in another hearing, are they here?
Here.
You want to join us? I don't recall your name, I'm sorry. Ruth Atkins, is it?
Janet Bird.
Janet.
For Memory Partnerships.
Okay, I don't have you signed up, so just tell us your name when the time comes, please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is John Van Landingham, and I think I should go first because I'm not going to talk about housing need, although that's usually what I talk about. I work as a lawyer for Lane County Legal Aid. My career is about representing low-income tenants and advocating for affordable housing. That's usually what I'm here for. I'm going to be in two other hearings today talking about tenant protections and affordable housing. I'm here today, though, as a proponent of this bill. I am also a strong supporter of Oregon's land use program. I served 12 years on the City of Eugene Planning Commission and 12 years on the state's version of a planning commission, LCDC. I was chair for the last 7 years on LCDC. That ended in 2012. So I am not an opponent of the land use program. In fact, I'm a very strong supporter of it. I support this bill as a modest experiment. I've referred to it as voluntary inclusionary zoning. What's the point? The point is the cost of land. Land, in my experience, inside an urban growth boundary is expensive. If you're an affordable housing developer, you have three choices in that case in order to do your project. You can charge higher rents. You can somehow hope to get greater subsidy. And often the legislature is the source, going to have to be the source of that subsidy, or you don't build your project. This is simply an experiment to see whether we can do something with the land use program that promotes affordable housing. Also note for you that there has not been a new manufactured home park built in Oregon in probably 20 years. Manufactured home parks are the largest privately provided source of affordable housing in the United States. We need more manufactured home parks. There will be closures. If we want those homes to be able to go somewhere, there needs to be somewhere for them to go, new manufactured home parks. Is the land use program part of the cost of land? My answer would be yes. Simple. Directly, you limit the supply of land, of course it has an impact on the cost. Indirectly, wonderfully in my view, we make our cities lovable, wonderful places to live. More people want to live there. We increase the demand. Is it the main cause of the cost? No. Is it probably SDCs are. But is it part of the cost? Yes. How much? No one knows. And we've spent years actually arguing about how much that cost is. This proposal isn't new. It came before this legislature in 2009. Representatives Witt and Gilliam were on the committee that heard it in a bill numbered HB 2225 in 2009. That bill came from a work group that I chaired when I was the chair of LCDC. That work group included the chair of the State Housing Council, an Ashland home builder named Larry Mediger, who has since died of cancer, but who originally suggested the idea. That work group included two planning directors, one from the city of Springfield and one from the city of Redmond. It included advocates on both sides of all the issues. And it drafted what became 2225, and 2225 from 2009 is the basis of this bill. I continue to support this concept. 7 years later. I've invested 24 years of my life as a volunteer land use planning policymaker. I think the program is wonderful. It's also complicated as hell and expensive, and it's resistant to change. I don't think the resistance is so much from the state level as it is from the advocates, and I think the program needs to try some different things, and this is one of those different things. Thank you.
Please.
Chair Clem and members of the committee, my name is Bill Hall. I'm the chair of the Lincoln County Board of Commissioners, first vice president of the Oregon Association of Counties, and I appreciate this opportunity. The League of Oregon Cities already has endorsed House Bill 4079, and today the Association of Counties Special Operations Committee will be considering it as well. Oregon's housing crisis is real, and it's getting worse by the day. For more than a decade, I have been hearing from employers in all parts of Lincoln County that housing quality, affordability, and availability represents a significant barrier to employee recruitment and retention. This applies at every income level, since our countywide rental vacancy rate is now 0.7%. So 2% would sound pretty good to us right now. Someone in the rental industry told me 0.7% means there's about enough time for someone to come in, vacuum the carpets, wipe down the fixtures, and let the next tenant move in. Just last week, I spoke to the CEO of our hospital in Lincoln City. A decade ago, her predecessor told me that he had nurses commuting from the valley due to housing issues. Today, that is still the case. I'm chair of the board of the nonprofit Family Homeless Shelter in Newport. I sat in on some of the organizational meetings for that shelter back in 1988 as a young reporter. The founders imagined that they were going to be serving families in crisis. I don't think they ever imagined that they would be dealing with families like the one who showed up to drop off an application last week. The mom and dad are both working. They've saved a nest egg for move-in costs, but they and their several children are living out of their van because they can literally find no place to live. I know that stories like these can be found in almost every corner of our state. Oregon's a big, wonderful, diverse place. Almost 4 million people spread across 98,000 square miles. The message I keep trying to get across when I talk about tackling our housing crisis is that we do need a large toolbox that includes many tools. What works in Portland might not work in Pendleton, and a great solution in Lincoln City might not be right for Grants Pass. Certainly, we do need more public investment in housing, but even in an ideal world, public agencies and nonprofits won't have the capacity to get the job done by themselves. We have to create some more incentives and remove barriers to private investment as well. To me, this limited, bipartisan pilot project will not harm the important core objectives of the Oregon land use system, while still making it possible to try an approach that just might make it easier for a nurse to live closer to the patients that he or she cares for.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird. I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. Neighborhood Partnerships is a statewide nonprofit organization with a 26-year history of working to increase housing opportunity in Oregon. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 4079. We see this as a modest step. You've heard that word before. It's 50 acres in two locations in the state, working closely with Department of Land Conservation and Development to make sure that we reach goals of 50-year affordability and appropriate choice of land. There are many proposals before the legislature right now, as a couple of folks have already referenced. I think it's important to think that HB 4079 is not a substitute for those. Neighborhood Partnerships is very much in support of the inclusionary zoning proposals that are moving forward. We think we need both of those tools in the toolbox. We don't see that HB 4079 threatens inclusionary zoning, but it's an important complement and a good tool to have. The other reasons that we're supporting House Bill 4079, again, we also see that affordable housing comes in very many forms, that affordable communities look different in different parts of the state. We need to see manufactured home park communities built and replaced. We need to also see dense urban development. We need this multitude of approaches. We think that the pilot project in HB 49 would stimulate some of the creative thinking about what housing needs are for people within communities and would stimulate creative solutions. Just a couple other things to call out. We think that it's a well-reasoned approach. We appreciate that it protects high-value farmland, and also that it creates that long-term affordability period of 50 years. Thank you very much for your service to Oregon, and we encourage your support of House Bill 4079.
I've got one question. You mentioned you support inclusionary zoning proposals. Does that include the one, I think it's a, I don't know if it's a House bill or a Senate bill, but it puts the rate at 30% of a project?
So my understanding is that there's been some discussion about whether that maximum 30% rate is what's going to move forward. I do think that local jurisdictions need to be able to look at what works in their jurisdiction, to sit down and do the math, and, you know, whether that's...
Up to 30%, that bill you support. Okay. I don't, but I'm glad you do. Is there a link between this bill and any of those inclusionary zoning bills, that if I pass this, it helps those 30% bills pass?
I don't.
That should be no. I would advise you. Chair Clem,
yeah,
right now.
I don't know the answer to that question. I do think, you know, as I think all three of us have said, we think that many things need to move forward this session, but I don't think that
If I might comment, Mr. Chair, there are a lot of discussions going on right now. This bill is part of those discussions. In my view, and I'm not the Speaker or the President of the Senate, but in my view, if the IZ bill moves, it will not be anywhere near 30%. Mm-hmm. But this bill is a part of the discussions that include that and a bunch of other things, too. I think you know that.
Yeah, I think there's probably some reasonable number. If somebody wanted to commandeer 30% of my fruit to feed the hungry, I would say no. That's how I feel about it. There's an amount that it's reasonable to commandeer somebody's project for societal good. 30% is too high. Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, this is a question for you. I mean, this is an intriguing opportunity, and I hope that folks will think carefully about how to craft it so it can be successful if it makes it out of the building, because that's the key in my mind. And that leads me to ask your opinion about what I view as an underlying problem that has brought us to this point, and that is how we count and assess needed housing under our existing statutes. Because part of that statute seems to say to me that we should have been tracking and providing for land for folks of low and moderate income all along, and that what has happened is cities don't really want to do it, and so they count differently. And I think this bill is a great conversation starter on some work that could occur later to address a long-term dysfunction. I'd be interested in a brief thought.
Chair Clem and Representative Helm, I don't think any discussion of the Oregon Land Use Program can be brief. I got involved in land use planning in 1988 as an affordable housing advocate. At the city level, we did a lot. We did a lot to encourage private development of housing and low-income housing development. I joined LCDC for 12 years, hoping to do the same. Never happened. And even as chair for 7 years, it never really happened. And there are a lot of reasons for that, and it's not because the commission and the department don't want to. It's hard to do change to this program. I believe this is a chance to try to do some of that change. There are a lot of factors in the land use program. You've identified one. Needed housing is a term defined in the land use statutes. It's pretty broad. We have another statute that requires cities not to have clear and objective standards in applying their local codes. Do we have an enforcement mechanism for that? Not really. Would it make a big difference if we did? I think it would. You know, home builders signed on to the land use program in 1973. Why? They understood that they were going to be regulated, but they thought they were going to get some certainty. And now what they would tell you is they're both regulated and uncertain. We have to find a way to get back to that certainty. And I'm hopeful that this is one very small part of that. I mean, talking about this would be worth a couple of beers.
Yep. So, one more question, and then we'll move on. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wanted to thank this panel this morning. I particularly wanted to thank Commissioner Hall for his continuing work on behalf of affordable housing. Bill, you mentioned that in Lincoln County we're suffering a 0.07 vacancy rate. What you didn't mention is that 50% of our citizens are challenged by the cost of housing. 10% of the kids in our schools are categorized as homeless. Mm-hmm. It's an astounding problem. My question for you is this. Part of the problem we've got in Lincoln County is supply and demand. We've got a limited supply, and the demand is being eaten up not only by workers but also by retirees and this emerging phenomenon of vacation homes, vacation rentals that are being built within our urban growth boundaries. This bill, what effect would this have on the buildable or rebuildable land that we currently have available? What's your sense of what's going to happen with those properties given the competing demands for that limited supply?
This bill, I would not think, Chair Clem and Representative Gomberg and members of the committee, I don't see this bill having a direct impact on the lands that are already within, say, especially the Newport and Lincoln City UGBs. You know, to be real frank, Lincoln City, I think, and Newport are both sitting pretty well with available buildable lands within their UGBs. So this is a tool. I don't expect to see Lincoln County at the head of the line to be part of this experiment. I think if some degree of inclusionary zoning, has been said, I don't think the bill will move at 30%, but if it does move at some level, I think that's a tool much more likely, much more suited to Lincoln County because, I appeared for that bill with Representative Kenny Geyer's committee, and, we heard a commissioner from Washington County talking about a 1,400-unit development going in, all 2,000 and 3,000-square-foot homes, and he sat down with the developer and asked, couldn't you see your way clear to including at least a few thousand-square-foot homes, starter homes, retiree homes, but the developer wasn't interested. So I think IZ in some reasonable form would also be a worthwhile tool, but I think it's really worth giving this a try to see if it can be of help in some places in Oregon where there is really significant development and infrastructure right up to the edge of the UGB.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thanks. I need to move on. Thank you. And let me call. Okay, on the way out, keep your ears open, Representative McLean.
I just wanted to make sure the members of the committee, as we hear testimony today, I know Representative Stark is very aware that his bill is part of a discussion, which contains many bills. We've heard it from our commissioner in Lincoln County about ICE, inclusionary zoning, for an example. But Representative Stark wants his bill to move in isolation. In other words, the other bills may move as well, and I know he has support of and is supporting some other solutions. But I know he would like our committee to evaluate the merits of his bill standing on its own. And I just wanted to make sure that was presented on behalf of Representative Stark to us before we heard testimony.
I won't bring up any other topics. She invited. I couldn't help it. I'm sorry. Okay, let's get I've got one person from more than 100 miles away on my list, so let me have Mickey Killingsworth come up. Since I'm down in the Farm Bureau realm, she's from Jefferson County Farm Bureau. Let me just go ahead and have the Oregon Farm Bureau come up. And I know I see. How about Kathleen? I know you're a farmer, or your family has got a farm. So do you want to come up too? Let's do the ag panel. Oh, Larry, he sensed you want a real farmer. There's one right there. But I don't have you on the list at all. Oh, no, you just got added at the end. Well, I'll bring you up in the next group. Okay, Ag.
Chairman Clem and committee members, I'm Mickey Killingsworth from Jefferson County. I'm representing Jefferson County Farm Bureau today. So the gentleman to the far right, Mr. Van Lamingham, if I pronounce his name correctly, he made my point as a farmer why I'd be concerned about this bill. He said we need cheap land to build in. So the bill is admirable. Affordable housing needs to be Representative Helm gave a good summary of why we're at where we're at. But having the UGB clause in an experimental bill, our County Farm Bureau says we can't support that. If that was gone, we'd be very happy. We were here last year testifying on UGB expansion on farm ground. What it does is it makes speculation. My farm is surrounded by homes already. It makes every bit of farm ground next to a UGB, speculation happens. And because this is an experiment, in our County Farm Bureau's opinion, where our fear is speculators will go out. We have young farmers trying to farm, trying to buy ground. It's tough, but it's really going to get tougher because you don't know which of those cities are going to apply to be the experimental one under 50,000 are next to a UGB on farm ground. So the smaller cities, you could have that. So if you're a good businessman, you're going to do speculation. And speculation, as the gentleman said, we want cheap farm ground to build on. My other concern was I didn't see a mixed use in the bill. It absolutely said no mixed use. People need mixed use. They need to be able to walk to their stores. They need to be able to get to jobs. They need to be able, putting them out on an edge, especially in a rural community, is not the most productive allocation of land. Jefferson County had a federal project put in 3 years ago, and the land that they put it in was in the UGB, and they made sure it was by a grocery store and a gas station and fairly close to a school. And the reason that was where everybody thought was a good place for it was most of those people who live in that low-income housing did not have transportation to live. If they would have put it on the south end of town, there would have been no place for them to get to walk to groceries or close to school and to go see their kids do things. And the one major industry, they could walk the half mile to that major industry. So the community did do input. But as a Farm Bureau, our concern is UGB expansion in a pilot program. We'd like to see that taken out and see what happens in the pilot program and go from there. I'll take any questions if you want.
Let's finish the panel first.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Mary Ann Nash here on the behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau. While we appreciate the bill's attempts to give concession to the issues around high-value farmland and around some sort of need analysis, we're not comfortable, as Mickey stated, with doing away with the current UGB process. We are concerned about the impacts it would have on agricultural lands, and particularly in the rural communities that we're talking about. That's going to be one of the primary industries in the county. We understand that the UGB expansion process has been one of the more contentious aspects of Oregon's land use planning system, but that's precisely because it attempts to balance the need for a reliable supply of rural land and the need to allow farmers to plan on a long-term basis for whether or not they're going to want to be able to pass that land down, sell it to a younger farmer without an inflated price point. And so there's a reason that it's a difficult process, and because it's trying to balance a multitude of needs. We are concerned about the provisions of HB 4079 that allow for UGB expansion without the evaluation of the need for new buildable land and without the priority of lands hierarchy currently provided for in the land use process. We think those processes appropriately balance the need for protection from development on agricultural lands. One of the issues that we've been seeing a huge increase of in Oregon is actually that conflict between urban and rural uses. And we've seen more and more complaints as people are even just renting, you know, properties within farmland, complaints about spraying, complaints about noise, complaints about dust. And I'm worried that siting a community siting affordable housing right on the edge of the UGB is going to increase some of those conflicts in the areas where this pilot program occurs without the protections that the current process has in terms of looking at where the ideal spot for these developments are. We are the second largest industry in Oregon and have been for a long time having to produce more with less, produce more food, more fiber with less land. And we understand that growth is going to continue to occur, and that trend will likely to continue to occur, but we need to make sure that while it does, we have all of the protections for agricultural land in place so that we can continue to remain a viable industry, so that our land prices do not become inflated, so that we still can have younger farmers and ranchers purchasing land and growing their operations and avoiding sprawl onto urban or onto rural farmland. So essentially, we admire the intent of the bill. We admire the intent to address the affordable housing issue, but we don't think UGB expansion, at least without regard to the current process, is the appropriate vehicle to address affordable housing impacts. We'd ask to look toward incentivizing development of affordable housing within UGB, making sure there's a need in communities, and then following the existing process and engaging in the communities to make sure that those can go forward. So with that, I will conclude. Thank you.
Okay, Kathleen.
Hi, my name's Kathleen Carl. I'm part of a family farm in Hubbard, Oregon, which just last year celebrated 100 years of operation. The fourth generation is running it, and the fifth generation is living there. I oppose House Bill 4079. Although I believe in affordable housing, I think this bill is an attempt to go around the land use laws that have helped maintain our farms and forests and the beautiful vistas we have. First, and to me the most important, is that our state has a process for cities to expand their UGB, and I think this is being circumvented. Cities do need to make affordable housing a part of their plan, not ask for illegal farmland expansions. And it seemed like several people spoke about the cities have the buildable lands, the developers don't want to build it, they just want to build huge houses. I think that this is something that this proposal should look toward that and figuring out a way to have a modest proposal, but within the UGB, and to make that possible. So the bill says the land should be for affordable housing, but not how much. And I know that Representative Stark said that this should be, mixed housing, different kinds of housing. I worry that the same thing's going to happen, that the builders will buy up the land, and then they'll want to, let's do 10% affordable housing, and let's make the rest big houses that people want to buy for a lot of money. So cities need to make zoning changes within their UGB to provide housing for the elderly, the single heads of household, and the lower income workers so that they can live close to services and easily get to jobs and shopping. Save our farmland. Follow the rules. Affordable housing should be part of cities' long-term plans and not spur-of-the-moment experiments backed, I think, by home builders. Thank you. Any questions?
We got to move on. We've got a lot of folks here. Well, let's test your theory and call the home builders up. Mr. Chandler and Mr. Cleave and Ruth Adkins. This will be an in-favor panel. We're just going to kind of go back and forth, pro, con. Until we run out of one or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here in support of House Bill 4079. I'm fascinated by the fact that this issue is getting so much attention this session, and I'm both fascinated and delighted. Affordable housing, even though I've mentioned in some other committees, and some of you may have heard this before, that I'm not sure that a problem that's been in the works for 40 years counts as a crisis. It is a problem in Oregon, and not just in the Portland area, but around the state, small cities, medium-sized cities. We have, there's for a purpose for others' conversation, I suspect, it's the net culmination of a variety of policy choices, some on purpose, some inadvertent, that have gotten to this mess. That said, I think unwinding it and doing something productive this session makes an awful lot of sense. We actually have a bill in the Senate, Senate Bill 1575, that Senator Edwards put in for us, that has a version of 4079 in it. I like this version a lot better than the one we came up with. You heard Commissioner Van Landingham talk about the bill from 2009. The Senate version has a bill from 2007 on the same topic, and the 2009 bill that is in 4079 is a much better take on this issue. A couple facts for you, though, in considering this bill and the package of bills that may be in front of you yet this session. We should be doing a little bit of background information. Oregon should produce about 25,000 housing units a year, all types, for sale, for rent, big, small, multifamily, single family. 25,000 housing units is about what we should be building in a normal year. That's not the 2005 Yahoo year. That's just births over deaths, family in-migrate, family formation, in-migration, that sort of thing. We're going to be doing about 15 as of last year. So we are 10,000 units short. We were 10,000 or 12,000 units short the year before, and we've been underbuilding by that roughly that same amount or greater ever since the recession, which means we have a backlog of about 100,000 units under what we should have produced. That's a big part of the problem we're trying to address or dealing with is simply supply and demand. And that's not to say the market left to its own devices will fix this, but doing things that impede the market will probably make things worse. Things that might improve that market, might improve housing production, like I believe this bill would do, should be encouraged. I think, and it's been said before, that, 4079 is a modest approach. We are talking about two pilot programs of 50 acres each, and while I understand the concerns of the Farm Bureau and others, I doubt the state's ag economy is going to collapse at 250-unit projects. And if we're really serious about affordable housing, then we have to, everything has to be on the table. I think the UGB process and the parts that go into that need to be on the table. I think system development charges, other costs of development need to be on the table. I think the underinvestment by the state needs to be on the table. I mean, frankly, members and Mr. Chair, if one measures the interest of a governmental body by the amount of money and time attended to that, then the interest of this legislature over the last 25 years in housing has been precisely nil. There's very no general fund put into the housing agency. It runs entirely on HUD money, federal pass-throughs. We're trying to change that this session and some other pieces of legislation. Local government imperatives need to be on the table. A lot of the problem that we're facing in trying to deliver affordable housing has to do with the land use system and permitting processes at the local level. And there may even be some role for using the development process, whether it be IZ or some other mechanism, to get to affordable housing. I am one of the many phrases that when I get to be king, we're going to eradicate from people's vocabulary is tools in the toolbox. It is overused, trite, and cliched. I'm going to use it anyway. If we have a toolbox and it needs to have tools in it, and some of the folks that you're hearing from today don't think anything's wrong with coming in and suggesting that my industry and the real estate industry generally ought to participate by selling houses at a lower price, having them commandeered in the words of the chair, then I think another tool in the toolbox ought to be the land use system. And I don't think that either of those by themselves will fix this problem. I think that a combination of both tools and legislative intent and focus will help us turn the corner. We got into this problem over a series of decades. It'll hopefully won't take decades to get out of it, but it's more than one session's effort. This bill, I believe, is part of that effort. I commend it to you. Be glad to take any questions.
And I am not leaving due to the next speaker, but I have to go for a little bit, and I'll be back. And
no one would blame
Vice Chair Hill is going to take control.
Turns out people still have opinions about the minimum wage, and a big employer in my district would like to talk about that for a moment, so I'm going to step out for a second. Go ahead,
John. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Association of Realtors, today in favor of House Bill 4079. Before I get into the details of why we support that bill, which Mr. Chandler provided a good outline of the basis of what I'll talk about, I want to take the opportunity to update the committee on the other pieces of bills, the omnibus bill, one of which is in the House, one of which is in the Senate. For me, the perspective on the ability to pass legislation really depends on two factors, complexity and controversy, both of which the land use system encompass. That being said, while I am hopeful that the other bills provide the basis to move things forward and to streamline in a comprehensive mechanism some affordable housing concepts, I think House Bill 4079 does provide the basis of an exceptionally easy to understand and executable program to address the affordable housing issues in Oregon. Specifically to the bill, this is an opportunity for both sides to kind of lay their cards on the table. You'll hear a lot of discussion about supply and demand, and that any high school economics course is going to demonstrate that as supply decreases, demand increases, and so do costs. If we are successful in this pilot program, and I hope we are, and if this committee moves this bill through the process, it provides an opportunity for the developer side of the equation to lay out their cards and say, here are the factors that we deal with. And at the end of the day, through this pilot program, we're able to decrease cost by X, right? With two pilot programs, we're hoping to demonstrate that. We have a built-in incentive to demonstrate that our talking point, supply and demand, is true. So we will be looking for opportunities to build out through that pilot program in a very, very modest way to demonstrate the argument that we would make over supply and demand. I do think it's a very modest approach, and given the discussion on complexity and controversy, it may be the only approach that's available this session. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Good morning, Vice Chairs Post and Helm and members of the committee. My name is Ruth Adkins. I'm here on behalf of Oregon Opportunity Network, also known as Oregon On. We're a statewide association of affordable housing nonprofits working across Oregon to provide housing and economic opportunity for hardworking families, seniors, people with disabilities, and others struggling to meet their needs in our communities. So along with many other partners, some of whom we've already heard from, Janet Bird and others, Oregon On is working hard on a significant, comprehensive, and urgent housing agenda this session, because Oregon is facing a crisis of housing access and affordability that is impacting people and communities of all sizes, both rural and urban. With over 20,000 school children experiencing homelessness in our state, the stakes have never been higher. We need to move on multiple fronts with the tools. It's a cliche, but it's true, with multiple tools, with great urgency and with creativity to keep families stably housed. We know that only with a stable home comes the best opportunity for health, for success in school and jobs, and prosperity. So in response to this crisis, we believe that HB 4079 provides a thoughtful and creative pilot project approach that we believe is worth exploring. We appreciate that the bill recognizes the special values of farmlands, focuses on non-metro area cities where the adjacency of services and infrastructure is more proximate, does call out the need for that housing to be located near the infrastructure, and has important provisions calling both for adjustment to market variance and for long-term affordability. We also appreciate the Dash 3 amendments, specifically calling out the necessity of transit corridor access, and also recognizing the absolute importance of simultaneous efforts for jurisdictions to increase affordable housing within the urban growth boundaries. So as this concept moves forward, nonprofit affordable housing providers would very much welcome the opportunity to be engaged around additional key details that need to be determined through rulemaking, such as the levels and percentage of affordability and what ratio of affordable housing to other uses might be required or expected. In the meantime, we're very excited to see creative ideas like this one to increase access to affordable housing opportunities in new and innovative ways. Thanks very much for the opportunity to testify and for your service to Oregon.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. Thanks to the tools as well. For this panel, if we pass this pilot project, and the worst fears expressed by Ag were to come true for whatever reason, would you feel good about trying and abandoning the pilot?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Gilliam, as with the nature, this is an experiment, and the nature of all experiments is they may work well, they may not work at all. If we try this and it fails to achieve the outcome that we're hoping for and it damages the state's ag economy, you're out 100 acres.
Representative Gilliam, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gilliam, I think that the author of this bill in 2009, Mr. Van Landingham, was really setting this up as a call in poker. If it does come back and demonstrates that there are disastrous effects on agriculture, that the outcomes don't meet the needs of the affordable housing community, then we lose. We lose. We can't use that talking point anymore. So, yes, there is risk on both sides with this approach.
Representative Witt.
Yes, I just wanted to ask the panel if there was a list of factors that comprise total housing costs by category. So X percent would be land cost, X percent building materials, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, good question, really good question. If you know me, you know that I'm a person who likes to rely on data. I think that a lot of what you see in the housing market is a reflection of irrational behavior. People want to live where they want to live. However, I think there are mechanisms to start to tease out what those components are. Of course, you have your labor, your construction costs, your land, your fixed costs in a certain area. Those costs are fluctuate based on the desirability of a particular neighborhood. One of the things that we've done at the Oregon Association of Realtors is engaged with a subcontract with Eco Northwest to help us put some real firm data behind that. Unfortunately, when we entered into that contract in early January, we haven't been provided enough time for those specific answers to the question you proposed to be made. I will say that in the initial data that we have, it does demonstrate that there are broad fluctuations. I hope that I don't think it'll happen this session, but I don't think that we're going to be solving the affordable housing crisis at the end of the session either. But over the interim into late spring, early summer, that we actually are able to quantify those costs for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Would there be an analysis of the cost that Oregon's land use planning system imposes on the housing market?
That is the long-term goal of the question we're proposing through this contract with Eco Northwest, yes.
If I could just add?
Real quick, we got three more panels.
So, Chair Helm and Representative Witt, just wanted to add, you know, from the affordable housing provider's perspective, it varies so much by locality and individual situation, but what we work hard to do is putting together both private and public and leveraging as many funding sources as we can, but it varies so much. What I appreciate in this is that it allows the flexibility while also recognizing the complexity of the challenges and trying this pilot in a couple locations around the state.
One more follow-up.
Thank you. I understand that it varies, and that's precisely why this information is needed. Mm-hmm. Precisely why. And, you know, we hear a great deal of discussion about housing cost inflation, and particularly about the impacts, true or rumored, that land use planning has on overall housing costs. And it gets to a point where the discussion can't be pinned down because there is not adequate data. So I would think that would be critically important to provide.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Witt, if I can. The variation is very difficult to quantify. We hope that ECO will be able to do that. We did a study with an outfit about 15 years ago, Bay Area Economics, on this topic. And for the $50,000 that we put into the study, found out that we needed to spend $150,000 to find out the answer. To give you a couple points of context, I wasn't being rude. I was looking for some numbers from one of my builders who does starter homes in Portland. I can get these to you separately. The land cost was $86,000. Permit closing, et cetera, $13,000. City fees, $37,000. Sales costs, $19,000. Total non-construction costs were $155,000. The hard cost, sticks and bricks, were $115, sales price was $305. So that gives you at least some context for a Portland project. You heard a mention made of Washington County and the problems there. In the Bethany area, which I think, that if I remember the story correctly, is where this conversation was occurring with the Washington County Commissioner, land there is $800,000 an acre, which is an absurdly high number, but that is what is being traded for in an open arm's length transaction. How much of that is land use? How much of that is speculation? How much of that is just flat hearing voices? Who knows? It's very difficult to tell. But that gives you the range of the problem we're trying to address and the fact that you do need a multitude of approaches to it. It's not going to work to just simply say, poof, and it happens, because if we could have poofed this, we'd have done it years ago. It is a very complicated topic with an awful lot of moving parts. This bill, which we're talking about today, is one of those moving parts in context, I think, is an excellent step.
Representative McClain. So many comments about poofing.
Poof.
And it would be nice. I used to call it pixie dust, if we could sprinkle pixie dust. You might want to try that. Mr. Cleve, would you be able to get for us what is the acreage of farmland in Oregon? I know you have some connections with the Farm Bureau. Maybe you could help with that. I'm curious because, you know, I'm not sure that the Parade of Horribles that Farm Bureau testifies at every single land use hearing is, I mean, how many acres are we talking about? So maybe you and Marianne Nash could at least get back to me on, you know, if we've, in other words, is this bill going to affect 1%, 10%, 1,000th of a percent of farmland? It would be helpful to know so that we can have a scope issue, at least part of the record.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative McLean, I'd be happy to provide some of that data for you.
Thanks. Thank you very much. We need to move on to the other panels. So, folks, we got one. I think we need to try to get through three panels so before the end of our time. So, Roger Kay, Becky Steckler, and Mary Kyle McCurdy.
Good morning, Vice Chair Helm, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kay. I'm current president of Friends of Marin County. I submitted a testimony, and you should have that in the record. Our organization and its individual members are opposed to House Bill 4079 and request a no vote. Friends of Marin County is a 501c3 farmland protection organization founded in 1998. Our mission is to protect farm and forest land, parks, and open space. There are several reasons we oppose this bill, and I will list a few here. HB 4079 appears to be an affordable housing bill, but it will not likely lead to any affordable housing being built. The bill short-circuits the current process. Cities are already required to provide a 20-year land supply, which incorporates all uses, including housing. This bill will have a significant negative impact on farm, forest, and resource lands. House Bill 4079 will take land out of the base of Oregon's number two industry, which is agriculture. Lands designated to come into UGBs must now be prioritized by quality. This bill does not allow for the protection of quality farmland. House Bill 4079 ignores the important cost calculation of converting rural land to buildable land. This bill will not achieve its intended effect and will only lead to more conversions of valuable farmland. House Bill 4079 is ill-conceived and a real threat to Oregon's landscape. We therefore request a no vote on this measure. And may I add, if Mr. Spock were here today, he would say this bill is illogical.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and have the whole panel speak, then we'll have questions.
All right. My name is Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Becky Steckler, and I'm the program and policy member for the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. And our members work every day for their elected officials around the state to build livable and complete communities. And apparently they're doing a very good job of that and definitely taking advantage of so many of our natural resources and economic opportunities as Oregon is the number one destination for people to move to. For immigration. We definitely applaud the efforts that the legislature is taking to try to address Oregon's affordable housing program this year and during this legislative session, and have no doubt that the Department of Land Conservation and Development and the Housing and Community Services Department could probably work more together to provide more tools for that toolbox, because it really will take a varied approach and many different strategies to address the different types of affordable housing situations that are in different communities around the state. excuse me. definitely one of the important aspects of that is really evaluating the housing needs, which is what Goal 10 requires that Oregon's land use planning program does and that communities do. And I would definitely say that the communities around the state are very anxious to definitely evaluate their urban growth boundaries under the new process. I've heard a lot of conversations, not only in this committee but others, about how difficult expanding an urban growth boundary is and doing that analysis, as well as how litigious that is. And so definitely the 2013 legislature took that into consideration and passed House Bill 2254 and directed the Land Conservation and Development to adopt new rules to streamline the UGB process. They went through a two-year process to update those rules with hundreds, if not thousands, of hours from experts and people who work with the program on a regular basis, and they just adopted less than about 2 months ago now new rules to streamline the UGB analysis. And that just went into effect on January 1st. So, and this new process, we are very hopeful, will create, it's a new optional simplified process where cities have to evaluate their UGBs about every 14 years or sooner if they've seen I think it's a 50% increase in the population forecast if that's been built out and those people have come. It's definitely designed to reduce litigation and to save time. As well as speed up the acknowledgement process. So LCDC has recently done just what everybody has asked it to do, and that is to streamline the process so it's easier and it costs less and there's fewer lawsuits related to it, and we're anxious to see how that works. And there's a lot of analysis that continues to go through it, and that's definitely one of our concerns, is the comprehensive nature of thinking about housing, needed housing, and affordable housing. I personally have no doubt that we could find two great affordable housing projects somewhere right outside of an urban growth boundary, and it won't be because it's outside of an urban growth boundary. It'll be because there's already been planning for infrastructure, that there's jobs or schools close by, maybe because it's a small community and everything's within proximity. And so really, I think allowing the new rulemaking process or the new UGB streamlining process to work is the best place to put that. I would put ask that if this bill is passed and a pilot project is done, that the Department of Land Conservation and Development, they are required to do an evaluation of that streamlining process every 5 years. And so if this is passed, that they include the pilot project and the outcomes from that pilot project into the streamlining so it can be kind of incorporated into that comprehensive need analysis of the need for all types of housing. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.
Good morning, Vice Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We appreciate the concern reflected in House Bill 4079 for affordable housing and that the bill is a pilot project. However, we oppose 4079, and I'm going to walk through a few of those reasons why. It offers the false promise of affordable housing relief while having significant challenges of practicality, fairness, and clarity. And in doing so, it breaks the balance that we currently have between urban and agricultural needs by our long-term land supplies inside urban growth boundaries. We're asking the agriculture, this bill is asking the agricultural industry to yet again bear the brunt of what cities should be doing. We would never ask this of any other industry. If 100 acres is really so small, why don't we ask the commercial sector or the industrial sector to provide some of the land that is already zoned inside urban growth boundaries, has infrastructure, and is already near schools, stores, and jobs. Agriculture is the number two industry. Why don't we take this land out of a sector that already is well located? If a city has a 20-year land supply, but it's still not meeting the needs of the housing needs of their citizens, then they have not stepped up to zone residential land supply to truly meet those needs. That means enough apartments, duplexes, attached single-family housing, accessory dwelling units, etc. Rezoning for these types is hard. It's politically hard. Yes, it's not a land use issue. It's a political issue. But that's what needs to be done to truly provide housing for all. That provides the opportunity for moderate and low-income workers, the elderly, and others to live in neighborhoods close to jobs, close to retail. House Bill 4079 sidesteps the reality of the tremendous expense required to provide a full set of infrastructure to raw land and the length of time it takes to build that out, and the impact of paying for those costs has on housing affordability. Of course, land inside an urban growth boundary is more expensive than farmland. It's because the public and private sectors have invested in the infrastructure required to bring it online for development. The impact of paying for those costs has an impact on housing affordability. They're usually borne in part by the developer or the eventual homeowner or renter through SDCs, and partly by taxpayers and ratepayers. The result of bringing more land into an urban growth boundary through this pilot project is that the infrastructure costs will be shared across the existing residents of the community and the future residents of those areas, making both costs unaffordable. We have on-the-ground examples of this flaws in this concept. In Washington County and Hillsboro, there have been two large urban growth boundary expansions, one of 700 acres in North Bethany and one of about 1,500 acres in South Hillsboro. Both of those were onto farmland. Nothing on it should be easy to urbanize. Both of those were promised to be easy to serve with public infrastructure because that infrastructure was at the edge of the urban growth boundary and would be easy to extend into those areas. The infrastructure costs in both those areas are running in the area of $100,000 per unit. That's because pipes and roads are expensive. This is in an area, Washington County, which has a lot of wherewithal to be able to provide that infrastructure, and where the cost of providing it is relatively inexpensive compared to some other areas of the state because there's lots of contractors and workers in the area. It's expensive. We should be stepping up to provide housing where that infrastructure already exists. And for that, I look to Medford as an example. Medford has recently done an evaluation of its urban growth boundary for the 2050-2050 time period. It knows where it's going to expand its urban growth boundary to accommodate that population. But as part of that, it upzoned almost 500 acres inside its existing urban growth boundary from single-family to multifamily housing. That immediately increased the capacity of the city of Medford to provide housing for all, and it also provided an opportunity for the Jackson County Housing Authority to purchase land to build affordable housing. It needed to purchase multifamily land, which wasn't available until then. This bill will take a year or so for rulemaking. That will cost the state money. We believe a much better use of that state's money and LCDC's time would be to enforce the existing law, Goal 10, to ensure that all cities do their part to provide housing for all. Thank you.
And committee members, in the interest of time, we have one last panel of folks that are not regularly in the building. So we're going to carry this over. So I'm going to ask the committee if we hold questions until the next chance to talk to these folks.
Thank you.
And then what we're going to do in the interest of time is I'm going to invite you decide. Elena Kenegi, Larry Dyke, David Engen, and Jennifer Johnson up now for the last panel of the day, and then Sybil Hebb and Peggy Lynch and Aaron. I'm going to ask you to come back next time since you're in the building regularly. So whoever would like to go first, please go right ahead.
Chair Helm, my name is Larry Dyke. I'm a farmer in Washington County, and I love land, and I love the farm. And as I've been listening to things today, everything is not about farmland. Everything is about money. Everything's about money. You know, farmland, if we look at the numbers, farmland sells for $10,000 or $20,000 an acre, okay? And from my belief, usually people, when they sell out, when the ground gets taken in, it might be $200,000. John from the Home Builders, he mentioned $800,000. Of what value of what the land costs before a house gets built on it. Then we've also heard numbers about permits, and I think John mentioned 80,000. Mary Kyle mentioned 100,000 for infrastructure. Okay, if we look at the numbers, the value of the farm of the land is not the significant, and is the intent of this bill to buy land from the farmer for the $10,000 or $20,000? Is that what the goal is? And to do that, that developer that buys 50 acres for one of these pilot projects, if he buys one of these 50-acre blocks from a farmer and pays him $10,000 an acre, he buys it for $500,000. And that developer, when he develops that property, if you use the number John mentioned, $800,000, that's $40 million, okay? If we're talking about affordable housing, what if this law allows a developer to buy land for $500,000 that's worth $40 million, I would think he would be able to put all affordable housing on the whole thing and provide it for free, practically. But anyway, thank you.
All right, thanks. We are running over our time, so you can be as concise as possible. That's great. And then there'll be time for you to speak again, I think, in the next hearing. Right.
Co-chairs Helm and Post, my name is Jennifer Johnston. I'm the Director of Health Strategy at Primary Health of Josephine County. We are a coordinated care organization, and I want to present a little bit different perspective on this issue. More the human perspective from Health and Human Services and how this is affecting us in our community, particularly a rural community. And I will try to condense as much as possible by just kind of putting this in context that people in our community are talking about housing in a different way than they were several years ago. And it's not the same people that were talking about housing that were talking before. Now we have people from the educational system coming together to talk about housing. And we have people from the healthcare community, healthcare executives coming together in meetings where when we are doing our strategic planning, we're pointing out housing as a key issue that's keeping us from meeting our goals of our organizations. We've had housing forums in our community that bring these individuals together so we can hear these different perspectives. Representative Stark attended our housing forum, and I won't go into all of the issues that we came up with because I think that they're broad and they're relatively well known. But I want to tell you, so we are discharging people home from the hospital into their cars, into the Walmart parking lot. These are our most expensive health plan members, our most at risk. And I will tell you, one of those health plan members that we discharged to her car was holding at that time a housing voucher that she had waited years for Section 8 housing, but she could not find a housing unit available to use that housing voucher for. So instead, she discharged from the hospital to her car, and her housing voucher ended up expiring. She was not able to use it in the amount of time that she had to use it. In another meeting last week, I was talking to a local physician assistant. She has a friend, another physician assistant, who came to our community who was not able to find a rental. She ended up moving a 20-something into a 55 and older community because that was the only rental that she could find available. So this is affecting all sectors. It's affecting our entire ability to provide services, not just low-income housing, but low-income housing is a big part of the issue. And I guess what I'll say is I'm in support of this bill because I feel like it offers a reasonable solution, a way for us to pilot something in a small way to see if it is effective. And I can tell you our community is willing together and try to provide the other resources to a housing community to try to make it work and try to keep people in that housing once they're placed there. But we need to start somewhere, and this seems like a logical first step.
Thank you for your perspective. Representatives, my name is Alana Kanagi. I'm a third-generation farmer from Benton County. I agree a lot with what's your name?
Jennifer
has said, and I think that we face a significant problem with gentrification and affordable housing in this state. However, I feel like the solution to that problem is better found in finding affordable housing within our urban growth boundary in abandoned, underutilized areas. As a farmer, I'm 26 years old, and when I look around at my farming peers, they're a lot older than me because those are the folks who have land at this point. I'm fortunate enough to have land because of my family, but when I look at my age peers who want to get into farming, it is extremely hard for them to acquire farmland and to pursue that goal of a vocation of farming. When I think of the, you know, what happens with a pilot project, and a pilot, you know, trying things out, that those are good intentions, right? But if you start developing a piece of land outside of the UGB or on the fringes of it, once you break ground and build a residence, it is extremely cost prohibitive to move that land back into farming, and even more cost prohibitive for those new generation of farmers to be able to acquire that potential land and bring it to back to the quality of soil that it once was. Thank you.
Thank you.
Honorable chairs and members of the committee, my name is David Engen. I have lived in the state of Oregon over 50 years. I'm 80 years old now. I was a professional seaman in my working life in the Navy and the Merchant Marine, and I've been around the world, most of the continents and much of the United States. This is not a unique problem to Oregon. It's not a unique problem to Oregon because of the land use laws or other states which do not have land use laws. They have this problem also, and it's not because of the land use laws. I know I had a friend, actually, who was an attorney here in town 15, 20 years ago, and she was buying up land for a developer outside Salem's or, UGB. I oppose this bill, and I heavily support the land use laws of the state of Oregon. Please do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you all. And again, since we're over, unless anybody has some burning questions, I'll go ahead and close the hearing, and we'll carry it over until Wednesday.
Thank you very much. At 8:30.
Wednesday. So we'll carry this hearing over to Wednesday at 8:30, and we'll pick up the folks that didn't get to talk today, and I would imagine that the chair would be indulgent in allowing other folks to testify as well. So thank you for coming today.